From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The police reacted really in an unprepared and rough way, I have to say. And at the moment, the last news we heard is that Martin is in the hospital in Lausanne, and he got two operations yesterday, and his backbones are fractured, and he got another fracture on the leg and another on his ankle.
A protester at the G8 summit in Switzerland is severely injured when police cut the rope he was hanging from while trying to hang a banner. He dropped 60 feet from a highway bridge. We'll speak with two indie media reporters in Switzerland, and we'll talk about why demonstrators went to France and Switzerland. Privatization of water, AIDS, and the new Partnership for Africa's Development. First, we'll take on the Justice Department's report on immigrants being held at detention facilities in New Jersey and New York, and find out why undercover police shot protesters with rubber bullets in Seattle. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Federal Communications Commission has voted by a majority of one to relax or eliminate decades-old rules governing media consolidation. The changes will unleash a major new wave of consolidation among newspapers, television, and radio companies. The three-decade-old ban on a newspaper buying a television or radio station in the same city is largely gone. The commission also has allowed broadcast networks to buy more stations at the local and national levels. The Republican commissioners, led by Chair Michael Powell, claim the rules were out of date with the rise of cable, satellite TV, and the internet. The two dissident commissioners said the lifting of the rules will stifle free speech. They said as local media operations are absorbed by large corporations, the news will become even more homogenized, and unpopular viewpoints, including those of people of color, will be forced off the airwaves. President George Bush has begun meeting with Arab leaders in Egypt, including the new Palestinian prime minister. Bush has until now avoided a personal role in the Mideast peace process, since so many U.S. presidents have failed to broker peace before. U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is also in Egypt for the talks. The BBC and The Guardian report one of the Bush administration's main goals is to secure Arab support for the new Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen. Mazen was installed after Israel and the U.S. refused to deal with Yasser Arafat. Bush is also looking for a strong condemnation of terrorism. The Egyptian foreign minister said Arab leaders will ask Bush for a firm commitment to the implementation of the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace. Arab leaders also want an end to Israeli invasions of Palestinian territory, assassinations, and house demolitions. This morning, Israel began releasing about 100 Palestinian prisoners as a sign of goodwill. But yesterday, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has rejected a request from Bush to declare an end to occupation at tomorrow's summit. The BBC's reporting Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian policeman in northern Gaza. Bush travels to Jordan tomorrow to hold his first summit with the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers. The G8 summit in Evian, France, is coming to a close today. Leaders from the seven richest nations in the world, plus Russia, issued an evasive closing statement, which declared, quote, "Our shared objective is a fully sovereign, stable, and democratic Iraq." Last night at their dinner, the leaders discussed a highly critical document prepared at an alternative summit last week by 1,000 activists. That document included calls for full debt relief for the nation's poorest countries, the enforcement of labor rights, and the creation of international rules to curb pollution. Bush missed that discussion as he'd already left for the Middle East. None of those recommendations made it into the final official draft. document. Outside the luxury hotel overlooking Lake Geneva, where the leaders met, beyond 25,000 police and a steel fence, protests continued overnight. Police used water cannons, rubber bullets, and tear gas against hundreds of demonstrators. The Senate Armed Services Committee has announced it will investigate whether the Bush administration used faulty intelligence information about alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in order to justify an invasion. The investigation is backed by both Republican and Democratic politicians. Virginia Republican John Warner, who heads the committee, said, quote, "The situation is becoming one where the credibility of the administration and Congress is being challenged." The top Democrat on the House of Representatives Government Reform Committee, California Democrat Henry Waxman, wrote a letter to Bush on the issue. He wrote, quote, "To date, you have offered no explanation as to why you and your most senior advisors made repeated allegations based on forged documents." Waxman also noted Bush's doctrine of preemptive strike rests squarely on the ability of the U.S. to gather accurate intelligence and make honest assessments. The BBC reports the inquiry will include public hearings that will be televised live. Leaders of seven key Iraqi political groups held an emergency meeting yesterday on Iraq ruler Paul Bremer III's announcement that the U.S. will appoint an interim advisory council instead of convening a national conference to choose a transitional government. According to the Washington Post, they lashed out at the decision but avoided issuing a joint condemnation because they still hope to change Bremer's mind. Meanwhile, hundreds of former Iraqi soldiers staged a protest in Baghdad demanding pay following the disbanding of the army. The anti-government strikes continue today in Zimbabwe. Opposition officials are vowing to continue despite a violent crackdown by police and troops. Yesterday, soldiers and armored vehicles fired live bullets and tear gas and assaulted protesters. In the capital, Harare, banks and most businesses are closed. And the UN mission in the Congo has confirmed reports of fresh fighting in the mineral-rich Ituri province. This after a spokesperson for an armed faction said yesterday nearly 350 people, mostly civilians, were killed in a weekend massacre in Ituri. The spokesperson also said government troops were involved in the slaughter. UN officials told the AFP they can't confirm civilians were killed, and it's unlikely they will conduct an investigation because they said they don't have the necessary human resources. Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday called for the tripling of the number of peacekeeping troops there.
Freedom, freedom, freedom. Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like I'm a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like I'm a motherless child. Sometimes I feel just like I'm a motherless child. Alone. Way my own love in freedom, 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 freedom.
Freedom, Richie Havens, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department report has been released concluding authorities violated the civil rights of hundreds of immigrants detained after September 11th attacks. At a federal prison where over 80 people were held, they said there was a, quote, pattern of physical and verbal abuse. The review by the Office of the Inspector General also found FBI officials made little attempt to distinguish between immigrants with possible ties to terrorism and those who simply had the misfortune to be swept up in the investigation. Without bail, detainees remained in jail for an average of 3 months. They had to wait for weeks until they were allowed to make phone calls and find lawyers. Some were kept for months in cells illuminated 24 hours a day and were escorted in handcuffs, leg irons, and waist chains. In one Brooklyn detention facility, some detainees said guards slammed them into walls and taunted them. We're joined by Rebecca Thornton, who is a fellow at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights and a spokesperson for a group of 20 organizations that met with the Office of the Inspector General when they were preparing their report. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you talk about the significance of this Justice Department report?
Well, I think it's a very important report because it confirms what advocates have been seeing since September 11th, which is the denial of counsel for detainees, the verbal and physical abuse of detainees in the detention facilities, delays in notifying an individual of the charge, the reason that they're being detained, including many obstacles to obtaining legal counsel.
Now, the facilities that they looked at specifically...
They looked at Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn and the Passaic County Jail in Paterson, New Jersey.
Can you talk about what specifically, what kind of abuse they said they found?
Well, one thing with respect to access to counsel, for example, prison officials instituted a communications blackout policy immediately following September 11th that lasted for several weeks, and this prevented individuals from having access to phones, visitors, even being able to send or receive mail. So that was a very significant finding by the report about denial of access to counsel rights. In addition, as you mentioned, the FBI often arrested and detained individuals on little or no evidence connecting them to terrorist activity, even though they were characterized as suspected terrorists. And that implicated many consequences, given that when you're designated a suspected terrorist, you may be detained in more severe conditions.
What are the recommendations of the report?
The recommendations of the report include things such as creating more consistent guidelines about what kind of evidence to base a finding of someone being of suspicion in a terrorist investigation, as well as guidelines on how long individuals should be detained without charge, requiring that the government notify individuals in a reasonable period of time, which did not happen.
Mm-hmm. There are no recommendations for criminal prosecution. So they admit, for example, in the Metropolitan Detention Facility in New York, that prisoners were assaulted, were abused, but they're not filing criminal charges against anyone.
That's right. The Inspector General stated that they specifically did not evaluate the legality or illegality of the various policies. But what you can see from the facts that the report lays out, as well as the conclusions made and what the recommendations say, that there certainly is a basis to show that the Justice Department has not acted within the bounds of the law.
The report makes it sound as if the Justice Department only detains something like 700 or so people. But the fact is countless thousands have been detained and continue to be detained.
That's right. There's really a range of policies that the Justice Department has implemented post 9/11. And I think some of those policies have not been reflected in the Inspector General's report. For example, there's a new absconder apprehension initiative that requires individuals to be detained if they have an outstanding deportation order. These detentions were clearly a response to anti-terror measures, but were not included in the report.
We're talking to Rebecca Thornton, fellow at the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights. The report said that there was a pattern of abuse in New York at the Metropolitan Detention Center, but not in Passaic. What do they mean, pattern of abuse?
Well, I'm actually disappointed that the report does not find the same kinds of patterns of abuse at Passaic that they did at MDC, because what we hear from the communities dealing with the families of detainees is that there are clearly abuses happening at Passaic County Jail. In fact, there have been a number of hunger strikes that have occurred, and I don't think that the Inspector General's report really evaluates those abuses at Passaic as much detail as they did at MDC.
Does an immigrant in a detention facility have a right to a lawyer?
There's no right to a government-appointed lawyer in the immigration system. However, they do have rights to access to counsel. So they are supposed to be given information about how to contact pro bono representation and be given access to telephones to make those calls. Those are some of the things that did not occur. Lists that were given to detainees of pro bono counsel were out of date and inaccurate, and access to phones was severely limited, and individuals at times were only able to make a call to a lawyer once a week. If they get a busy signal or a voicemail, that counts as their one call per week. So it was severely limited.
Finally, what does this report mean for groups like yours, like the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights? What can you do with it?
Well, I think it's a very important first step towards accountability. You know, the Justice Department has shrouded many of its activities in secrecy, and this is a first, kind of the clearest sense we've had of what's really happening internally in the government. So there are a number of options to pursue as far as encouraging Congress to adopt new legislation that would create better protection for rights, as well as implementing new policy guidelines.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Rebecca Thornton with the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights.
Thanks
thank
so
you.
Much.
You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move across the country to Seattle, Washington. Yesterday, protests took place there, undercover police and uniform police shooting rubber bullets at protesters. They were protesting the LEIU, the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, a network of intelligence and law enforcement agencies from Homeland Security to police agencies. We're joined on the phone right now by Mark Taylor Canfield, who's an independent journalist with Pacific affiliate KBCS, as well as the Indy Media Center in Seattle. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what happened? There's been very little word of these protests.
Well, the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit, you know, was formed decades ago, and it took us some time to sort of catch up on what they're about. But there are many cases of abuse where activists have been surveilled by arms of this department, and files shared in instances such as the story you covered in Denver with the police files that they were accumulating on activists. Those files ended up with the LEIU. So we've been trying to educate ourselves up here for a couple months.
When you say those files ended up, the story that I remember in Denver was that all of these secret police files that were kept on people were given back to the people they were kept on. You're saying that a copy of them also went to the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit?
Yeah, one of the people that spoke up here, her name is Susan Siegel, and she's with the American Friends Service Committee in Denver, for one of the groups that was investigated. And she told us that one of the tactics they tried to use was to send those files to the LEIU. The problem with the LEIU is that it's a semi-private law enforcement network with federal funding. And its objective, supposedly, is to try to link up all the information networks among law enforcement agencies in the U.S. from Homeland Security down to your local state and, you know, local police forces. And Tom Ridge was one of the attendees at this conference. So there was a definitely a presence of Homeland Security here. What happened was is that there was a hotel where the conference was being held, and there was a rally at Westlake Center earlier today at 6 p.m. So the marchers went to the hotel and decided to linger, and what they ended up doing was occupying two streets, 4th Avenue and 5th Avenue in downtown Seattle. And after a couple of hours, one of the demonstrators had climbed up to the second story window and had burned a flag, and when he came down, there was a very violent arrest by the police where he was literally pulled backwards over the barricade and then shot blank, you know, point-blank range with rubber bullets. So the crowd reacted really angrily, and that started a confrontation where pepper spray was used on the crowd. Then a crowd of several hundred people rushed the barricade in front of the hotel, the Red Lion Inn, and then more pepper spray was used, and then the police started to basically cordon people off and then try to move them down the street back to Westlake Center, where the original rally had begun at 6 o'clock. Using their bicycles and their truncheons, they got people down to 4th Avenue and Union Street and opened up with concussion grenades, flash grenades, rubber bullets, some reports of wooden dowels. So basically they were firing at the crowd, at the backs of the crowd, because the crowd was moving back towards the park. They hadn't stopped. Earlier they had been occupying the intersections.
It looks like people who were trying to capture images of what was happening were particularly hit. An Associated Press photographer doused with pepper spray, a Post Intelligencer photographer sprayed and hit by a rubber bullet. Also, a legal observer was hit and hospitalized?
That was one of the most disturbing scenes to me. There was a legal observer, I believe, associated with the National Lawyers Guild, and he was carried away on a stretcher and, I believe, a back brace, and he looked like he was in a lot of pain, and I did hear him say that he had been shot with something. So there were definitely injuries, even though, as the usual status quo in Seattle is that the local media doesn't report the injuries. But there were injuries. I watched people being taken away by medics, and I talked to medics who had treated dozens of people for pepper spray injuries to their eyes, people who were taking off their clothes, their shirts and things because they were doused in pepper spray and it was burning their skin. And then at least we know at least a dozen people that were arrested, but we're still, of course, we've been up all night trying to figure out where people are, who's in the hospital, what's going on at this point. Tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, people are going to show up at the city council chambers in downtown Seattle to complain to the city council. And then at noon, another protest has been organized by students at Seattle Central Community College on Capitol Hill.
Well, Mark Taylor Canfield, I want to thank you for being with us. Independent journalist reporting to us from Seattle, Washington, about the protest outside the Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit Conference, the LAIU Conference. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Switzerland and France, where the G8 have been meeting, and thousands protesting outside. Stay with us. Helter Skelter, the Beatles, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The G8 summit in Evian, France, has come to a close. Leaders from the 7 richest nations in the world, plus Russia, issued an evasive closing statement which declared, quote, our shared objective is a fully sovereign, stable, and democratic Iraq. Outside the hotel overlooking Lake Geneva, where the leaders met, beyond 25,000 police and a steel fence, protests continued overnight, Police used water cannons, rubber bullets, tear gas against hundreds of demonstrators. Over the weekend, police severely injured a 39-year-old British protester, Martin Shaw, when they cut the rope that he was hanging from while trying to hang a banner. He dropped 60 feet from the highway bridge and suffered multiple fractures. Police also raided the building some protesters were using as their headquarters. Independent media journalists reported police were dressed in anarchist black block gear. This was also a report that came from the anti-corporate globalization protests in Genoa, Italy. Police brutality against protesters was also prevalent at the G8 meeting there. Italian police shot a 23-year-old protester twice in the head, then ran over his body with an armored vehicle. That was in Genoa 2 years ago. Some 500 others were injured there. Well, yesterday we got two indie media reporters on the line with us covering these protests in Switzerland, Jackie Suen and Francesca Bria. Francesca Bria witnessed the police cutting the rope that Martin Shaw had been using to hang the banner. We asked her to describe the incident.
Yeah, so there was an action at about 11 in the morning yesterday on the highway between Lausanne and Geneva. And it was an action organized by around 15 activists from all around the world. And it was a peaceful blockade of the bridge. They put a rope throughout the highway. And at the two ends of the rope, there were two activists hanging. And it was a bridge around 30 meters high. When the police got on the bridge, the first thing they did was panicking. And without listening to the activists, they were explaining the situation and that if they would do anything, you know, roughly, they could kill the two activists hanging off the rope. The police just started panicking, and they removed the activists from the highway, went towards the rope and just cut the rope. And we were there, we were five activists from IMC Italy filming, and we could film the whole images, so we were testimony when the police cut the rope. And immediately after, Martin is this British activist, he fell down the bridge. And luckily, there were the other activists that were taking part of the action could run to the other side and pull the rope, avoiding that also the other young activists that was hanging on the rope could fall from the bridge. So it was really, really peaceful.
Can you explain how they stopped the other person from falling?
Because when they realized that the police cut the other side of the rope, luckily there were some other activists start pulling the rope so that she couldn't fall. And the police was there like without even helping. They were just afraid that the traffic was blocked for half an hour. And also the important thing to say is that they took almost 1 hour just to get ambulances and fire brigades on the spot, while we even thought that that Martin could be probably dead because he fell like 10 meters high. And so it was really, really, the police reacted really in an unprepared and rough way, I have to say. And at the moment, the last news we heard is that Martin is in the hospital in Lausanne, and he got two operations yesterday. And his backbones are fractured, and he got another fracture on the leg and another on his ankle. But he didn't hit his head, and he didn't have any head trauma, so he will feel better soon.
The police are saying they did not know he was hanging from the rope.
Well, the thing is that the action was very well prepared. These were all very experienced activists. Martin itself is a very experienced climber, and the action was really well set up. There was a first line of activists just hanging a banner that made contact with the police, and in front of my face, but also in the footage, you can clearly see that the activists were explaining to the police the situation, and they were explaining that there were two people hanging from the rope, and I even see them looking down. So they could clearly see the setup of the action. But I have to say, like, some of them looked really confused, and they looked that they acted before they even could realize what was the actual situation on the spot. So I can really imagine that some of them didn't realize or really didn't know what they were doing.
What did the banner say?
The banner would say G8 illegal, and another banner would say don't shoot us. Yeah, this was the message of the action. And the action was really well prepared, as I just said, because it is this tactic of peaceful blockading, and actually they could, I mean, it was done very good in a way that it could really block the traffic on the highway, and so that means blocking the delegation going from Lausanne from Geneva to Lausanne, and then to go to Evian for about 2 hours, or even more, like 2 or 3 hours. So it was, it could have been a really effective blockade, and just because of this, you know, police reaction, and it became a bad accident.
Francesca, you come from the Italian IMC. How does this compare to Genoa? What has taken place here and the police reaction?
Well, what I have to say is just yesterday, when the police came into the media center, the whole scene looked quite familiar to us. We had a really bad memories coming over because of what happened in the Diaz school in Genoa. And I mean, the general atmosphere is that here there is a lot of conflicts going on, but it's like more diffuse. And I mean, it's not the dimension of Genoa G8. It's clearly a different phase. It's a different stage of this movement. And you know, this is clearly reflected on the types of actions that we are seeing here in Switzerland and France.
Francesca Bria, one of the independent media reporters who police have also been targeting. As we turn now to Jackie Suin, who we reached barricaded in the Indy Media Center yesterday as police surrounded it. She's with Big Noise Tactical Media and the Independent Media Center at the G8 protests.
So I'm here with Indy Media Switzerland in Geneva for the G8 protests, and there have been protests organized in the surrounding areas around Evian, France, which includes Switzerland and a camp by the border called Annemasse. And there have been protests beginning Thursday, protesting against the secret meetings, the illegal meetings of this G8 summit, which the decisions are made without consulting any people who will be affected by these decisions. And so there have been a lot of protests around the environment, around Africa and structural adjustment, a whole myriad of causes that fall into the general rubric of anti-corporate globalization. And the protests began yesterday in Geneva, where I'm based, with road blockades, and the protesters managed, about 2,000, 3,000 protesters, managed to block almost all of the bridges in Geneva for a specific period of time. And there were very few confrontations with police at that time. And the idea was kind of symbolic, to block these bridges in order to delay the arrival of the delegations, including the heads of state, to Evian and the G8 summit. And they were successful in doing that. In fact, the delegation in Annemasse blocked the translators from arriving in time. And we also heard just generally there was an official announcement that the start of the meetings had been delayed somewhat. There were also blockades in Lausanne, Annemasse, and there were blockades in the highway from Lausanne to Geneva. And on one of those blockades, as I'm sure you've heard, a 40-year-old man who was in an action which involved him hanging from a bridge was cut down by the police and fell and was seriously injured. He really could have died. The police simply cut the line without any concern for his safety and without listening to any of the warnings by the team of people that were there supporting him. And in Geneva, the protests continued with a large demonstration during the day, which was very peaceful.
Jackie, according to the police, they did not know that he was at the end of the line.
But they were told over and over and over again that this line was the only thing that was holding him there, and to cut it would mean him falling a very large distance. And so they were either well aware or they were, you know, consciously not listening to the many warnings of the people who were there. They did admit later on in the afternoon, after first denying it, that it was them that cut the line. But they first denied that.
Continue with your description.
Continue with what happened in Geneva. So the protests were quite peaceful. It was a large protest later on in the evening, starting around 5:30, 6 o'clock. Various confrontations began with the police around the area that I'm in now, which is right along the river and right next to the cultural center where the Indie Media Center is based, called L'Usine, or the factory. And the police stayed at quite a distance, but fired tear gas for about 3 hours. And there were various blockades set up along the roads surrounding the cultural center. And then they began to slowly close in on us and close in everybody from the center or push them away. But there still didn't seem to be that many police. And I was actually outside. I was filming. People were sitting down. They thought the situation had calmed down. And then all of a sudden, really out of nowhere, about 20 police officers came through the small police lines that had already been set up around us. But they were dressed as Black Bloc protesters. They were fully masked. They were wearing, you know, hooded sweatshirts and shorts, all that, looking very much the part of a Black Bloc protester, except they had these orange police armbands, and they came wielding metal batons up to the front of the door. At that point, myself and one other Indie Media camera person who was there and the many people who were simply gathered in the cafe area came up to the door to prevent them from coming in. They never stated why they were coming in, that they were coming in, what was wrong, and obviously they were disguised in this incredibly curious way to have come in easily without being, by catching us off guard somehow. They pulled back for a moment, and then they charged the door. And at that point, they began beating various people and arresting people. I was beaten myself over the head and in the face. My tooth was cracked and concussion. A man beside me, his skull was cut with a very deep wound. He had to go to hospital. Another man in front of me was taken away in an ambulance right there. He was bloodied on the floor. They never said what they were doing. At that point, we gave them all of our identity cards. And the people who had been in the door, including myself, who had been beaten immediately, were put in handcuffs. And we were taken away to a Geneva police station. And I'll return to what happened to me later, but at that point, the police kept going into the building and controlling, quote-unquote, all the people who were there, taking their identity cards. The Indie Media Center was raided after about half an hour. All the people who were inside had locked the door. The police broke the door down. But what they didn't realize was that we were live streaming the entire process. We were filming their entrance into the Indie Media Center, and this was being broadcast over the Geneva 3 live stream that we've been conducting. And so we were actually able to get that out as it was happening, and we have documentation of these police officers coming in, which is very important because they tried to hide all pictures and prevent the press from capturing them dressed as these Black protesters. They didn't damage any equipment inside. They did prevent people from taking photos after an amount of time, and they shut down the stream. But other than that, everybody is okay. My journey continued from the police office, where myself and 10 other people who were arrested at the scene were controlled, and then we were released. But instead of being released in the city, the police officers actually, against Swiss law, drove us about an hour outside the city in the middle of a field, and we had to find our way back. Returned, and the protests were still continuing. There were still some clashes with police around the city. It was very, very tense. And today we've heard that, again, there are clashes in the center of the city, and there's a demonstration heading our way. And so we're actually now barricaded inside the Indie Media Center, no one going in or out.
Can you describe what the police looked like that beat you up?
The police that came in were all masked. They were wearing bandanas or small gas masks over their face. They had hooded sweatshirts, baseball caps. They were quite young. They looked, I mean, really like the many people who had been out on the barricades, the Black Bloc protesters that the media likes to bring out and that we've seen, actually, in these different demonstrations.
Were they trying to look like that? Were they trying to disguise themselves as that?
And the only thing that identified them was this small orange police band. But, in fact, they had been these same people. I recognized them from earlier, from about half an hour earlier. They had been simply walking around dressed like that in the crowd, scoping the situation. And one undercover police officer did actually come into the Indy Media Center without any police identification and just supposedly to take refuge. But, in fact, he was a police officer, as we discovered later. They were told as soon as these special units of masked, disguised police officers attacked, some of them went outside to do some crowd control, and they were promptly told by the uniformed police officers to get inside, and the press was prevented from taking pictures of them for the most part at that point. And when they all came out, as it was only the special units that were arresting people and beating people inside. When they came out in sort of a cordon with uniformed police officers on either side, and they actually ran from inside the building to their police vans. They obviously didn't want to be seen. They kept their masks on at all times, didn't want their identities known. And it seems to be routine now for the police to use the pretense of violent protesters to attack independent media centers and to shut them down for periods of time. They did that, as you remember, Amy, in L.A. during the protest there, the Republican convention, and they did it in Seattle, and they did it in Genoa, and they did it here, many other places as well. So the independent media really has become a target, and we need to make a statement against that.
What about the destruction of businesses in the area? What is described in the mainstream media as the looting, the smashing of windows. Who is doing that?
They were masked protesters, what would be called the Black Bloc. They were people who I didn't recognize from the other demonstrations. It was a small group of people. There were maybe, 50 to 100 people, definitely more like 50 by the end. It was a very small group of people, and the damage is quite limited. I mean, you could drive through Geneva and not know that there had been violent protests, except for the fact that the entire city has been barricaded, really, with these with wood. All the windows have been covered with wood, almost. But the damage was quite limited, and it consisted of breaking windows. There were no buildings burnt or cars burnt or anything like that. It was fairly low level, I would say.
And in terms of the counter-summit activities outside of protests in their streets, have there been alternative forum summits? What have they focused on? What about the Evian Water Challenge, and what are you hearing about inside? Is there any kind of dialogue inside out?
They seem completely separated, the counter-summit activities and the summit activities. There seems to be very little dialogue, but there have been amazing experiments, I think, not just presentations about alternatives, but an actual attempt to enact these alternatives in the villages that have been set up in Lausanne, Geneva, and Annemasse. These are large campsites that have been set up for people to come. In the case of Annemasse, almost, I'd say, between 5,000 and 10,000 people were staying at that campsite. And within there were media centers, there were workshops and trainings happening every day, there was a radio station, there were various things happening all the time. It was very full of life, and people were really dedicated to the idea of creating an alternative space and not simply being reacting against the events of the summit, but providing real concrete alternatives and trying to see what those would mean in practical terms by living them out.
And right.
I think the independent media centers have been another, alternative in terms of the corporate news as well. And what I didn't mention before is that not only was I arrested as a journalist, but there was another journalist arrested at the same time, also from Indy Media, but with official press accreditation hanging around her neck at the time of her arrest.
And the scene right now, you say you're barricaded in. Can you describe what's happening?
The scene outside seems very calm, actually, and we're simply taking these precautions, but you can hear tear gas canisters being shot and rubber bullets being shot at distances away. The train station is about 10 minutes from us, and you can hear explosions from there every so often. It's a demonstration of about 300 people apparently heading this way, but for now, immediately outside of us, things are quite calm, but we have been told that the police have been planning not only to raid the center again, but to try to shut it down completely.
And can you describe again, when you were taken away, where were you taken to?
I was taken to a police station within the city, probably about 5 minutes away from where I was arrested. But then upon my release, as I said, against Swiss law, they drove us without telling us where we were going about 40 minutes into the countryside and left us four women by ourselves at midnight in the middle of a field next to a highway. And we were treated quite roughly at that point, just kind of pushed out of the car with all of our belongings by four police officers.
And how many people would you say have been arrested?
There were 20 people arrested yesterday, 11 of whom were arrested at the Usine. That's the latest reports, but there's varying arrests happening even right now that we're just getting word in. The biggest series of arrests happened yesterday at a campground in Lausanne. One of the villages, the official village, in fact, was surrounded by police, and all of the people inside were detained, about 280 people at the end. And again, it was supposedly simply to control their identities, and they were held in the incredible heat for about 4 or 5 hours. And at the end, most of them were arrested. 40 people were held, and the other 240 were let go.
So you were not officially charged?
We were not charged with anything at all. In fact, in all of the cases, the raid at the Usine and the campground raid in Lausanne, these places where the police have simply come in without any pretext at all, not even providing a reason, the only thing that they've said is that they just want to control people's identity. And they've been taking down people's information, their names, et cetera. But they're not charging people with anything. And because of that, they're not providing them with lawyers. And they're simply holding them, sometimes brutalizing them, and then letting them go.
Is it true that Evian is completely blocked off, that no protesters can get in, that a train...
There's no way to even approach the city of Evian. It's been completely sealed off. And the latest reports is that even the talks and those activities sealed off to the media as well. So the protesters knew this far in advance, and they tried to get as close as they could to the city. But they were also pushed back. Yesterday, we saw some fairly amazing images from NMS of encounters with that protest with the police, which involved an incredible amount of tear gas as well. But thankfully, no injuries and no arrests.
Is it true that a trainload of people who are going to participate in the Evian water protest were prevented from getting in, and so the protest's been canceled?
Throughout the week, there have been various people prevented or delayed from passing through the borders. But getting through the borders is very difficult. But in terms of specific instances, I think the best thing is to check all of the latest updates on the Indy Media sites and the special coverage because obviously there are more and more people, and we expect that there'll be more people detained at the borders as people leave the country.
Jackie Suen, indie media filmmaker, often helping out at Democracy Now!, suffered a concussion, her tooth broken, as police attacked her at the Indie Media Center, the G8 Summit. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with two of those who went to raise concerns at the G8 Summit about issues of privatization of water and what happens to Africa when the most wealthy countries in the world meet. Stay with us.
I've been thinking about how to talk about green. I've been wondering if I could sing about the green. Trying to find a way to talk about green. Greed is a poison rising in this land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops its work and never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed's sneaky snare. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been thinking about how to talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Not partial to gender or your sexual desires. All it wants is for you to want to own, to possess, and to buy. Nothing seems to stop it once it enters your soul. As you buying anything?
It's greed. Sweet Honey in the Rock here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we listen to what happened to the protesters, why were they in Geneva area in Switzerland and Evian, France? We're joined right now by Jokey Jehu of the 50 Years is Enough Network, has just flown back to Britain, and Olivier Hodeman with Corporate Europe Observatory, which is based in Amsterdam. Let's start on the issue of the privatization of water. Olivier Hodeman, can you talk about what was called the Evian Water Challenge?
Excuse me, could you repeat the last?
Can you talk about what was called the Evian Water Challenge?
The G8 summit in Evian, a number of major initiatives were presented by the government, which were presented as solutions to the drinking water needs of the hundreds of millions of people in the poorest countries of the world who don't have access to clean water. There was this G8 action plan, which was drafted by mainly the French government, which is most of all an ideological document, which really emphasizes very strongly the role of the private sector, of private water companies, and which in a number of specific proposals presents subsidies, like development aid money, for private water corporations as the solution to deliver clean water to the poorest in the world. So a kind of a subsidizing of privatization.
Jokey Jehu, can you talk about the role of African countries, some of the poorest countries in the world, in the G8 summit?
Well, I think that the G8 leaders, who realize that they are an illegitimate body, have learned the value of public relations. So last year in Kananaskis, Canada, and this year as well, they've had a number of heads of government from Africa. Last year it was all Africa. This year they had Lula, they had the Chinese premier, they had the prime minister from Malaysia, because they understand that, you know, it doesn't look very good when they meet as the leaders of the eight most powerful countries, economic and militarily, and decide the fate of the rest of the world. And so we have these African leaders who have come, who came to the to Switzerland and to who participated in some of the G8 meetings. But I think that for my African colleagues who were in Geneva and in Annemasse, people are really saying that, what these leaders are doing is playing a role in the selling off of Africa through privatization of resources, including mineral resources, but also of services like water and electricity.
There was an alternative, a counter summit that 1,000 anti-corporate globalization activists attended last week and put together a document that supposedly some of the G8 leaders looked at last night. Can you talk about what that is and what you are calling for?
I'm not familiar with the document, but I think I was at the counter summit. I was on Saturday. There was a debt tribunal, and also at the same venue, which was at the UNIMEO University in Geneva. There were other sessions going on around Middle East issues and other kinds of issues related to globalization. And then the day before, there had been a whole day long, again, of teachings and symposium addressing a whole range of issues. And what is very clear to people is that the leaders, I mean, we've known this, that the leaders can't be trusted and that they will come together and make the deal. At the time of the war in Iraq, there was some people thought that perhaps, Chirac and Schroeder from Germany had emerged as the friends of people fighting for global justice. But what is clear is that at the end of the day, these leaders will come together. They will kiss and make up to some extent. It wasn't as a huge success as they had hoped, but they will make up and continue with the agenda of corporate globalization. And really, you know, the fight now is about the divvying up of the spoils of the war in Iraq and looking around the world at where else they can get something to divide up amongst themselves. And for the people at the teachings, it's again both analysis, but also talking about alternatives. You know, we've done the analysis. The figures are there; they speak for themselves, and it doesn't look like they're paying any attention, or if they're paying attention, it's taking too long for their response. And you know, I say that I thought of it that where we need to go, we need to think very creatively and really step out and step up front. In a strategy, kind of like the kind of strategy that we saw in the late days of the apartheid regime, that really, at one point, it was very clear that all the strategies we had been employing were not working, that we needed something different that would really break open this stranglehold of apartheid. And I think that that's where we are in terms of the control of multinational corporations, the role of the G7, G8 countries, the role of the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization, strategies that are going to really open up this and bring real change, boycotts, really militant rejection and opposition to privatization. You know, we see in France right now with the transportation union fighting against the sort of privatization of pensions. What are the kinds of strategies that we need to really apply to make sure that we don't just continue to say no, and they march on as if we didn't matter or as if we didn't exist.
Well, Joki Jehu of 50 Years is Enough Network and Olivier Houdeman of the Corporate Europe Observatory based in Amsterdam. I want to thank you both very much. The meeting of the World Trade Organization, which was raised throughout this summit, is taking place in Cancun, Mexico in September, and many people are preparing protests there. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Our website is www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. And if you want to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Those commissioners voting in favor of the item signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed signify. The item is adopted. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Over the cries of protesters, the FCC votes to scrap or overhaul decades-old media rules, likely unleashing the largest wave of corporate media consolidation in U.S. history. We will also speak with the nurse who is the victim of the Women's Health Clinic bombing that Eric Rudolph is accused of committing. Eric Rudolph has been moved from Asheville, North Carolina to Birmingham, Alabama to stand charges for a series of bombings. All that and more coming up. Despite fierce opposition, the Federal Communications Commission yesterday voted by a majority of one to eliminate or overhaul decades-old rules governing media consolidation. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The changes will unleash a major new wave of consolidation among newspaper, television, and radio companies. More on that story in a minute. We'll be joined by one of the dissident commissioners who has held forum around the country calling for a delay of this overhaul. President George Bush has begun meeting with Arab leaders in Egypt, including the new Palestinian prime minister. Until now, Bush has avoided a personal role in the Mideast peace process since so many U.S. presidents have failed in their attempts to broker peace. Secretary of State General Colin Powell is also in Egypt for the talks. One of the Bush administration's main goals is to secure Arab support for the new Palestinian prime minister. Abu Mazen was installed after Israel and the U.S. refused to deal with Yasser Arafat. The Egyptian foreign minister said Arab leaders will ask Bush for a firm commitment to the implementation of the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace. Arab leaders also want an end to Israeli invasions of Palestinian territory, assassinations, and house demolitions. This morning, Israel began releasing about 100 Palestinian prisoners, but yesterday, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that the prime minister, Ariel Sharon, has rejected a request from the White House to declare an end to the occupation. The BBC is reporting Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian policeman in northern Gaza. Bush travels to Jordan tomorrow to hold his first summit with the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers. The G8 summit in Evian, France, came to a close today. Leaders from the seven richest nations in the world, plus Russia, issued an evasive closing statement which declared, quote, our shared objective is a fully sovereign, stable, and democratic Iraq. Last night at a dinner, the leaders discussed a highly critical document prepared at an alternative summit last week by 1,000 activists against corporate globalization. That document included calls for full debt relief for the nation's poorest countries, the enforcement of labor rights, and the creation of international rules to curb pollution. Bush missed the discussion. He'd left already for the Middle East. None of the recommendations made it into the final official document. Outside the luxury hotel overlooking Lake Geneva, where the leaders met, beyond 25,000 police and a steel fence, protests continued overnight. Police used water cannons, rubber bullets, and tear gas on hundreds of demonstrators. All of this comes as France is facing a massive strike involving nearly all sectors of civil service. The staff of most of the national rail system last night began 2 days of work stoppages. Air traffic controllers have scheduled 3 days of stoppages. Postal workers have called for an indefinite strike, and teachers have been protesting for nearly 2 months the government's attempt to overhaul their retirement plans. Mass marches are scheduled for today, and workers in the steel, car, and banking industries will join in. The London Guardian notes a conflict of similar proportions in 1995 brought down the French government. Austria is in the middle of its largest strike since World War II. Buses, trains, trams, and the underground rail network went into operation shortly after midnight last night. As in France, workers are protesting the government's plan to cut their retirement benefits. In Germany, thousands of steel and engineering workers are expected to go on strike on Thursday. In Italy, airline workers forced a major airline to cancel 200 flights today. And much further south in Zimbabwe, the anti-government strikes continue today. Opposition officials are vowing to continue despite a violent crackdown by police and troops. Yesterday, soldiers in armored vehicles fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters in the capital, Harare. Banks and most businesses are closed. Here in this country, a Justice Department report released yesterday concluded authorities violated the civil rights of hundreds of immigrants detained after the September 11th attacks. At a federal prison where over 80 people were held, there was a, quote, pattern of physical and verbal abuse. The review by the Office of the Inspector General also found FBI officials made little attempt to distinguish between immigrants with possible ties to terrorism and those who simply had the misfortune of being swept up in the investigation. Without bail, detainees remain in jail for an average of nearly 3 months. They had to wait for weeks until they were allowed to make phone calls and find lawyers. Some were kept for months in cells illuminated 24 hours a day and were escorted in handcuffs, leg irons, and waist chains. The Senate Armed Services Committee has announced it'll investigate whether the Bush administration used faulty intelligence information about alleged weapons of mass destruction in Iraq in order to justify the invasion. The investigation is backed by both Republican and Democratic politicians. Virginia Republican John Warner, who heads the committee, said, quote, "The situation is becoming one where the credibility of the administration and Congress is being challenged." The top Democrat on the House of Representatives Government Reform Committee, California Democrat Henry Waxman, wrote to Bush saying, "To date, you have offered no explanation as to why you and your most senior advisors made repeated allegations based on forged documents." The BBC reports the inquiry will include public hearings that will be televised live. The General Accounting Office yesterday asked Congress to recommend the Pentagon triple its most recent estimate of the number of troops exposed to radioactive chemicals during the Gulf War demolition of sarin gas stockpile at Nkamasia, Iraq. This comes after analysts concluded the Pentagon was using flawed science when it calculated its estimates. The Pentagon originally estimated no soldiers were exposed. Then in 1996, it said 400 were exposed. And in 1997, the Pentagon increased the number to 100,000. Now the GAO says some 350,000 troops should be presumed exposed, roughly half the U.S. forces that served in the first Persian Gulf War. And the UN mission in the Congo has confirmed reports of fresh fighting in the mineral-rich Ituri province. This after a spokesperson for an armed faction said yesterday nearly 350 people, mostly civilians, were killed in a weekend massacre in Ituri. The spokesperson also said government troops were involved in the slaughter. But UN officials told the AFP they can't confirm civilians were killed, and it's unlikely they will conduct an investigation because they don't have the necessary human resources. Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday called for the tripling of the number of peacekeeping forces there.
Down, I am floating away. into the old casket of my hometown on election day. What is it about Birmingham? What is it about Buffalo that the hate-filled wanna build bunkers in your beautiful red earth? They wanna build them in our shiny white snow. And now I've drawn close the curtain in this little booth where the truth has no place to stand, and I am feeling oh so powerless in this stupid booth with this useless little lever in my hand. And outside, my city is bracing for the next killing thing, standing by the bridge and praying for the next Dr. Martin Luther King.
Hello, Birmingham. Ani DeFranco. In the second half of the show, we will speak with a nurse who was blown up in the bombing of a women's health clinic in Birmingham, Alabama. Eric Rudolph has been charged in that bombing. He has now been brought to Birmingham, Alabama to stand trial. But first, we turn to the historic event that took place yesterday in Washington, D.C. Despite fierce opposition, a sharply divided Federal Communications Commission yesterday approved an overhaul of the limits on how much media companies are allowed to own. Opponents warning of the dangers of extreme media concentration for news gathering and entertainment vowed to fight in the courts and Congress to overturn the new rules, which the FCC approved in a 3-2 party line vote. In the biggest markets like New York and Los Angeles, the new rules allow a single company to own up to 3 local television stations for the first time and to own both a newspaper and TV station. The rules also expand the number of markets in which an owner can have up to 2 stations. First, let's go to the meeting that was held yesterday in Washington, D.C. We turn to FCC Chair Michael Powell.
Today, we complete the most exhaustive and comprehensive review of broadcast ownership rules ever undertaken. We have done so obligated by our statutory duty to review the rules biannually and prove those rules are necessary in the public interest. The Court of Appeals has interpreted this standard as placing a high hurdle before the Commission for maintaining a given regulation, and made quite clear that failure to surmount that hurdle based on a thorough record must result in the rule's modification or elimination. This is an exceedingly difficult charge, but a critical one to fulfill if we hope to continue to promote the cherished values of diversity, localism, and competition. Over the past 20 months, we have been working tirelessly towards achieving 3 critical important goals. The first, reinstating legally enforceable broadcast ownership limits that promote diversity, localism, and competition, replacing those that have been struck down by the courts. 2, building modern rules that take proper account of the explosion of new media outlets for news, information, and entertainment, rather than perpetuate the graying rules of a bygone black and white era. And 3, striking a careful balance that does not unduly limit transactions that promote the public interest while ensuring that no company can monopolize the medium. I am confident we succeed by today's order. This proceeding has been the subject of extraordinary public attention. To my mind, it is right that it has been so, for the values these rules are intended to advance are critically important to a vibrant democracy. I have heard the concerns expressed by the public about excessive consolidation. Though such generalized worries do not clearly suggest specific answers to the specific issues the Commission must address. They have introduced a note of caution in the choices we have made. Consequently, our decisions today, retaining the rule against networks merging, tightening the limits on radio ownership, and modifying rather than eliminating the remaining rules, are modest, albeit very significant, changes. But I must punctuate one irreducible point. Keeping the rules exactly as they are, as some so stridently suggest, was not a viable option. Without today's surgery, the rules would assuredly meet a swift death. As the only member of this commission here during the last biennial review, I watched firsthand as we bent to political pressure and left many rules unchanged. Nearly all were rejected by the court because of our failure to apply the statute faithfully. I have been committed to not repeating that error, for I believe the stakes are perilously high. Leaving things unaltered, regardless of any change in the competitive landscape, is a course that only Congress can legitimately chart. For these reasons, we have embraced a challenge unparalleled in the FCC's history. We collected a thorough record, analyzed our broadcast ownership rules from the ground up, and wrote rules that matched the times. For the first time, we documented the state of the entire industry, empirically analyzed different transactions and their effect on our diversity goals, and, I think most importantly, sought the views of our citizens as to how they obtain their news and public information in an effort to craft rules consistent with the actual rather than theoretical viewing and listening patterns of Americans. I am confident and proud of the job we have done. I believe that our actions will advance our diversity and localism's goals and maintain a vigorously competitive environment. But before concluding, I would like to express my deep appreciation of my colleagues for their tireless effort over these past many months. Commissioners Adelstein and Copps have organized numerous hearings throughout the nation and deserve credit for bringing unprecedented public input to this proceeding. Commissioners Abernathy and Martin have been actively engaged in every step of the process and contributed enormously to the order that's before us today. I admire the genuine commitment of all four of my colleagues to serving the American public in this proceeding. And finally, they are simply not enough words of commendation for the spectacular efforts of the men and women of the Media Bureau. Their dedication and commitment are in the finest traditions of public service. And to them, I and the American people are forever grateful. Commissioner Adelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a sad day for me and I think for the country. It may be sunny outside, but I'm afraid a dark storm cloud is now looming over the future of the American media. This is the most sweeping and destructive rollback of consumer protections in the history of American broadcasting. The public stands little to gain and everything to lose by slashing the protections that have protected them for decades. This plan is likely to damage the media landscape for generations to come. It threatens to degrade civil discourse and the quality of society's intellectual, cultural, and political life. For those reasons, I dissent, finding today's order is poor public policy, indefensible under the law, and inimical to the public interest and the health of our democracy. In the end, this order simply makes it easier for existing media giants to gobble up outlets and fortify their already massive market power. It capitulates to too many of the long-standing demands of the media companies that we oversee. This approach, I think, shatters the last vestiges of the consumer protections that weren't eliminated in the 1980s. This decision pulls the teeth out of the remaining rules, leaves the FCC a toothless tiger. As big media companies get bigger, they're likely to broadcast even more homogenized programming that increasingly appeals to the lowest common denominator. It may take a while for the public to feel the full effects of this decision. Consolidation in the media markets could take place over a number of years, just as it did in radio. But people will notice every time a new merger goes through that eliminates a voice in their community. Their anger will flash as people surf through the channels, only to find more sensationalism, more commercialism, more crassness, more violence, more homogenization, and noticeably less serious coverage of news and local events, just as many Americans have warned me they expect to happen if we allow further consolidation. Judging from our record, public opposition is nearly unanimous, from ultra-conservatives to ultra-liberals and virtually everyone in between. We received about 750,000 comments from public in opposition to relaxing our ownership rules, and that was a new record. We've never seen that kind of an outpouring. We've only seen a handful in support. The hundreds of citizens that Commissioner Copps and I heard from directly at field hearings across the country, not one stood up to call for relaxing the rules. Of the thousands of emails I personally received, I saw only one that didn't oppose further media concentration. The American people appear united in believing that media concentration has gone too far already and should go no further. I've heard it said we can't make decision by polls or weighing postcards. I think that's fair enough. But the statute doesn't let us simply dismiss the public's views with a passing reference in a single paragraph, as this item currently does. The public is joined by a bipartisan chorus from over 150 members of Congress, organizations from nearly every political stripe, from the NRA to the National Organization for Women, expressed grave doubt about the wisdom of allowing greater consolidation. We heard from artists, academics, media moguls, Republicans, Democrats, Greens, everybody in between. And let me tell you, the Americans we heard from know what they're talking about. This is the media they watch and view every day. They take this very, very personally, and they have been very articulate and substantive in what they have to say. We heard from people who've collectively spent billions of hours watching TV, listening to radio, and reading newspapers. There's no better expert witness than the American people. There's no more objective jury. But today's decision overrides the better judgment of the American people. It instead relies on the reasoning of a handful of powerful media companies who have a vested financial interest. Those who stand to benefit by buying and selling the public airwaves are winning out today over the public. Now, anyone who questions whether consolidation can cause harm need only look to the experience of radio. The most constant refrain I heard from coast to coast was complaints about the homogenization and lack of news coverage on the radio dial in recent years. People begged us not to let happen to television what happened to radio. But the majority didn't heed this concern. By ignoring this history, we may be destined to repeat it. The Supreme Court has said that, quote, promoting the widespread dissemination of information from a multiplicity of sources, end quote, is of the highest order. So safeguarding diversity should not be subject to abstract diversity scenarios or arbitrary decisions that reduce the number of voices people can hear. I don't mean to suggest that bigness is always bad or that free enterprise will always fail the public. Free enterprise serves the public so well in so many ways and is why we have such a wonderful proliferation of outlets and ideas floating through the airwaves today. There's nothing inherently wrong with earning profits from using public property. But when it comes to gaining even greater profits at the expense of the cornerstones of our democracy, we've got to carefully question the effects on the public. Today's rules just don't let the big get bigger. They'll effectively prevent smaller entities from ever breaking in. I would have relaxed the rules more incrementally and shown the public each time how they'd benefit. Since my arrival here 5 years ago, I've approached this proceeding with a constructive frame of mind. I sought to understand the various proposals and their underpinnings and offer my views on their efficacy. Even after others closed in on an approach which I could not get comfortable with, I made reasonable attempts to moderate the proposals which were denied. In the end, it wasn't the process that precluded me from participating in drafting and supporting today's order. It was the substantive direction the item took and the results-driven imposition of bottom-line, bright-line rules ahead of all else. I'm disappointed that a majority of my colleagues could not be persuaded to take a more reasoned, conservative, case-by-case approach. But this is far from over. Congress may prove more responsive to the citizens who passionately plead for the independence of the diversity of their media. To paraphrase Winston Churchill, this is not the end or even the beginning of the end, but just the end of the beginning. Thank you.
Those commissioners voting in favor of the item signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed signify.
The item is adopted. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Mass regulation of the mass communication is the end of democracy. I said mass regulation of the mass communication is the end of democracy. I said mass regulation of the mass communication is the end of democracy. Mass deregulation of the mass communication is the end.
And with that, the vote signaling the greatest overhaul of media ownership rules in the country went 3-2. Michael Powell, the chair of the FCC, leading the way. We will go to break. When we come back, we'll be joined by the spokesperson for the FCC, Ken Faree. We'll be joined by one of the dissident commissioners, Michael Copps, as well as one of those who protested in the FCC hearing room. Stay with us. Willie Dixon in the news here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we talk about the FCC vote that could unleash the largest wave of media consolidation in U.S. history. One of those who was in the hearing room yesterday who was taken out by security was Medea Benjamin, of co-founder of Global Exchange. Medea, can you talk about what happened at the end of the vote and why you were protesting?
Well, first of all, let me say, Amy, how difficult it was to even get in that hearing yesterday. We got there the earliest. Our Code Pink group stood online for several hours, and then merely because we were wearing pink, they were so afraid of us, they didn't want to let us in the main room, wanted to stick us in the overflow room when there weren't any people there yet. They took away all our signs. They took away anything that could be that we could maybe hold up as a protest. So they weren't too interested in free speech to begin with. And then after the five commissioners spoke, we got up and we were told we couldn't shout, so we decided to sing. And we sang "Mass Deregulation of the Mass Communication is the End of Democracy." And I think what we saw yesterday was a vote that was a terrible vote, but two heroic commissioners, one who you're going to have on, Michael Copps, and the other, Jonathan Adelstein. And I must say that I was really proud to not only hear them speak, but proud of their defying the head of the commissioner and going around the country and really soliciting input. And it's not many times that we see people in these positions stick their necks out like these two commissioners did. And so for me, while I was extremely upset about the vote yesterday, I am encouraged that we have these two commissioners and we have a number of people in Congress who are willing to go the next step now and try to undo what happened yesterday.
We're also joined by Ken Faree, spokesperson for the Federal Communications Commission, made a presentation yesterday before the vote. How do you see the significance of this vote and what will unfold now?
Yeah, sure. Happy. First of all, I should clarify, I'm actually chief of the bureau, the person that oversaw the staff effort. The staff spent 20 months drafting these proposed rules that were put before the commission yesterday. I am not a spokesperson for the commission per se. As to the changes that were made yesterday, I'm very confident that these were well-balanced, well-thought-through changes that had to be made in light of the growth of media in this country, their number of outlets that are available, the number of sources that are available today are far greater than when those rules were adopted 30 and 40 years ago.
What about, for example, in places like New York and Los Angeles, the new rules meaning a single company can own up to three local TV stations for the first time and to own both a newspaper and TV station, as well as rules expanding the number of markets in which an owner can have up to two stations? How do you address these issues of unleashing a wave of media consolidation like we've never seen in this country?
what wave it will unleash. I mean, that's all predictive. Some people think it will, some people think it won't. Our challenge here was we're faced with a statute and with several court decisions telling us that we had to be able to justify any restrictions that we imposed on the record. So when you talk about a market like New York or Los Angeles with over 20 TV stations in it, if we were to say you can't have three, for instance, we have to be able to explain to a court on what basis we would impose that restriction. Does it cause a competitive harm in the market for one entity to own three? Does it cause a diversity harm in the market? And particularly when you're talking about balancing not only the harms on one hand, there may be incremental losses of diversity from a company owning more than one TV station, but there's also evidence in the record that there are localism gains in the sense that these companies often, when they buy a second or third TV station, do more and better public interest programming, more news programming. The ratings go up, apparently reflecting the fact that they're providing service that the community likes better than it did before the station became part of a group. So there, it's a balance. As all things in public policy are, you can always focus on the harms, but there actually can be some benefits that come too, and it's trying to weigh those two things in a reasoned way that we can justify in court, and surely we will end up in court again, to have rules that are enforceable to prevent the kind of unfettered combinations that you're talking about.
I wanted to get your response to the news conference that was held afterwards by an interesting group of senators, including Republican Senator Trent Lott, and, well, this is Democratic Senator Fritz Hollings of South Carolina.
I think everybody's on notice now that we're in trouble, and the Congress tried to react. We communicated very forcefully with Chairman Powell. It was ignored. It's certainly ignored within the decision now that's come out this morning. So if needs be, yes, there could be a rider on the appropriation bill that no money should be expended by the FCC to administer the Powell rule. That's clear, isn't it? let the contributions begin.
And that was Senator Fritz Hollings of South Carolina. Ken Faree of the FCC, your response.
Well, yeah, of course, we always listen to members of Congress, but we also have to follow the law. And the law is passed by Congress and signed by the president, requires us every 2 years to engage in this exercise. Indeed, we are 6 months behind on this one. We are about to start the 2004 biennial in about another 6 months. So this is, you know, we have to do what the statute tells us to do. There is no discretion here for the FCC. We could not have waited. We could not have put this off. We had to make a decision.
We're also joined on the phone by Hannah Sassaman, who is a longtime opponent of the media consolidation decision yesterday. Hannah Sassaman is with the Prometheus Radio Project. Your response?
Well, first of all, I'd like to address the point that quality really improves and public interest really improves in local broadcasts when those outlets are acquired by larger companies. The studies that were commissioned by the Federal Communications Commission are often contradicted by other excellent studies, including this one from the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which was funded by the Pew and Columbia Journalism School. Their organization found that TV operations that were owned by smaller companies were twice as likely to rank high on measures of quality, like breadth of topics and sourcing and the balance of viewpoints, than stations owned by the nation's 10 biggest group owners. So I think it's really important to realize that the studies that the FCC commissioned, which were also, again, not released in terms of their methodology and in terms of how they happened until very, very late in the game, those studies are often contradicted by very, very reputable organizations. So it's really difficult to say that that localism is going to be improved by this consolidation push. Many folks believe it's going to really, really, really go down.
You know, the one thing that isn't hard to say, though, is that the ratings go up in every case. So I would think that, at least, you can argue about studies, but ratings, I think, indicate what people like to watch.
I really believe that that is one of the biggest problems at the FCC. When someone like Michael Powell says that the market is his religion, when someone like Michael Powell calls the corporations, which he is supposed to regulate, his clients, of course the FCC is going to say that ratings, that the different programs, no matter how bad they are, if they get people watching them, is going to prove that there is localism or that there's good diversity in the content. I really believe that the American public has stated very, very clearly in the over 500,000 comments that is sent in to the Federal Communications Commission that they want localism, that they want diversity. And the coalition which has been built to fight for these things, for localism, for diversity, for independent media, is not going to stand back and allow the bills that have been proposed in Congress and in the Senate to rot away. We're going to support those bills and support that legislation in order to counter this FCC's very, very disrespectful push to deregulate. Disrespectful of the voices of the American public.
Ken Furey, I wanted to ask a question. The actions are seen as a major victory for media giants like CBS parent Viacom, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, and Tribune Company. All of them have been able to at least temporarily cross some limits of the old rules, and now the lifting of the cap from 35% to 45% will mean they don't have to sell off some of their media empire. Do you see a conflict of interest between a company like Viacom that will profit so handsomely from these rule changes? A conflict of interest between Viacom, their role in lobbying and in paying, giving money to FCC officials like you, up to that report that the Center for Public Integrity put up, FCC officials rack up $2.8 million travel tab with industries they regulate. They refer to Viacom sponsoring 7 trips, costing close to $10,000, spending close to $7,000, bringing you, Ken Furey, FCC Media Bureau Chief, and a top legal advisor to Chairman Michael Powell to a company management conference in March 2002. And here you are, the chief architect of the proposal to overhaul the media ownership rules.
Boy, that was a lot. I'm not sure what to respond to there. Let me start with where you started, which was on the rules. And you point out exactly why this is not a great victory for the media giants. The companies like Viacom were over the old cap. And guess what? They were over the old cap because the old cap was unenforceable, as were all of the other old rules that everybody seems to like so well. When we tried to enforce them, we lost in court. Had we continued to try to enforce them, we would have continued to lose in court. And I'm not sure that would have benefited the American public or anybody, for that matter, other than maybe the big media giants. What we tried to do yesterday was adopt rules that we can defend in court and that we can win on in court that will contribute to a diversity of voices in the market, improve competition within the market, and protect all of the interests that everybody purports to want to have protected here.
But that issue of Viacom, which owns CBS, spending $6,900 to bring you to a company management conference in 2002.
Yeah, we traveled to lots of different conferences. This is our way to get out and learn about the industry, tell them about things that are going on in the FCC that affects the industry, but more importantly, they're educational for the staff to go, particularly on technology, to learn about new technologies and how they operate, and to see, in some cases, facilities in use in the field. So it's not uncommon at all. I think the numbers that we're talking about are not out of line with anything that's happened in the past, and this is, I think, pretty routine.
Can I address this quickly?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, that same study by the Center for Public Integrity also showed that you and that others of your staff really didn't come out to advocacy meetings. You didn't come out to advocacy conferences. You didn't come out to public media conferences. You just went to these industry conferences and went.
I've done a number of public advocacy things. I did one in Chicago with the minority media owners. I did one in Florida with public educational government television station people that do public access work?
Well, the FCC defunds or refuses to fund Commissioner Copps's hearings all over the country, and when the number that Ms. Goodman stated is the amount of money that they're spending on sending you to industry conferences, I think that there's quite a bit of disparity there.
Yeah, you're confusing two things, though. We do have a very limited budget here. What we're talking about is when other entities pay for us to go out to see facilities, to get out of our ivory tower here in Washington outside the Beltway and see what's going on in America. That's different than when the commission pays for it. But by the way, when I did the public interest groups, the FCC did pay for it. We didn't ask them to pay the bill.
None of the trips examined were sponsored by consumer groups or individuals, all by the larger corporations like
That's
Viacom.
Right, the FCC paid on the other one.
Well, we're going to go now to Michael Copps, who is one of the dissident commissioners. And I know, Ken Free, you didn't want to be on with him. Hannah Sassman, thanks very much for being with us as well, of the Prometheus Radio Project.
Thank you.
Commissioner Copps, your final comments on this discussion, but more importantly, the mass overhaul of the media ownership rules that took place yesterday, and where you see the movement going from here.
Well, good morning, Amy, and thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for all the good work you have done in trying to help make the American people aware of this issue, and I think you were very successful in doing that, judging from the outpouring of sentiment that we have had. You come out of a day like yesterday with mixed feelings. Obviously, I was disappointed that we didn't carry that vote, even though we didn't expect to going in there. But I also come out with a good deal of hope for a number of reasons. Number one, there are avenues of redress here, from reconsideration petitions that could be presented to the commission, but probably more importantly, congressional avenues of redress. There has already been legislation introduced to reverse some of what was done yesterday. We have a hearing coming up tomorrow morning before the Senate Commerce Committee. Senator McCain, Senator Hollings, Senator Dorgan, Senator Lott, and others, all of them have serious questions about the direction that the commission is going, and they want to find out what's the state of play down here and what are our thoughts for the future of the industry. So we have that option. And then there are the courts. I think we can count on the fact that there will be contests in the courts over these rules. But what most enthuses me about the future here is that this has become, thank God, something of a grassroots issue, in spite of the fact that the FCC did not do a very good job in outreach and trying to inform the American people of what was going on, and in spite of the fact that big media until very recently just about ignored this this issue, and only recently has done enough to help tee it up. But it is teed up now. We are 750,000 people writing to the FCC, contacting the FCC. We see very clearly that the only place this is apparently a partisan issue is right here within the commission, because on the Hill it's not partisan. Around the country it's not partisan. It's not Republican or Democrat, liberal or conservative, north or south, urban or rural or anything else. It seems to be an all-American grassroots issue.
Senator Hollings saying that they would consider attaching a rider to the appropriations bill, cutting off money to the FCC to enforce any of this or to allow this to happen?
Well, that's one option on the appropriations route, and then there's just the normal authorization legislation process where you would just do something specifically, like on the 35% cap. I think something has already been proposed to go back to the 35% cap rather than go ahead with the 45%.
Well,
so there are a range of options there.
Well, we will certainly continue to cover this beginning tomorrow at the hearing in Washington, D.C. in Congress. Thank you very much for being with us. Dissident Commissioner Michael Copps, one of two of the five commissioners who voted against the media ownership rule overhaul that was voted on yesterday. That we are now going to turn after the break to the nurse who was bombed in the attack on the Women's Health Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, as Eric Rudolph is taken to Birmingham to stand charges. Stay with us.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC, NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
General Ireland, thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An article in the Birmingham News describes his arrival. Eric Rudolph was flown to Birmingham, Alabama, arrived at the Jefferson County Jail after 1 p.m. Monday, riding in a red Ford Crown Victoria, followed closely by other cars filled with rifle-wielding agents. Law enforcement snipers on the roof of the nearby Sheraton Birmingham Hotel watched as U.S. Marshals and Jefferson County Sheriff's deputies led Rudolph, wrists and legs shackled, into the back of the jail. Rudolph still wore the orange jumpsuit assigned him at the Cherokee County, North Carolina jail, where he had been held since his Saturday capture. Yes, after the largest manhunt in U.S. history, the man charged with two attacks on women's health clinics, the Atlanta Olympics bombings, and a gay nightclub has been captured. Federal authorities deciding to send him to Birmingham, Alabama, where he will be charged first. It was there one morning, 1998, that a bomb exploded outside the New Woman, All Woman Health Care Clinic. Police Officer Robert Sanderson was killed. Nurse Emily Lyons was critically injured. And she joins us in the studio right now. Welcome to Democracy Now! It is very good to have you with us. As you hear that description of Eric Rudolph brought to Birmingham, your thoughts?
Satisfaction that he's been captured and he will stand trial for the destruction and death that he caused in Birmingham.
Can you describe, if you will, and I know it's painful to go back to, but you have done it many, many times, to that day, what happened? Where were you in and around the building?
Okay. I was about 12 feet away from the bomb that day. I was closer to the building than Sandy was. So after the suspected bomber detonated the bomb by remote control from across the street, I woke up about 4 weeks later. Severe pain, and of course, the bomb did kill Sandy instantly. It's been a long 5 years of recovery, and the problems associated with that day will never go away.
You were walking into the clinic.
I was at the front door talking with Sandy, according to the witnesses. I don't remember that day at all, that we were talking, and he motioned me to go back towards the building, and he went over and stood over the flower pot with his nightstick, and then that's when the suspect detonated it.
I don't think most people realize it was a detonated bomb.
Right. It wasn't a timer. He was standing across the street, and he watched what he did to us.
It's an amazing story how he was identified. Can you talk about the medical student?
I don't know who that is. That has been kept very secret.
The medical student who saw him walking away from the clinic when other people's instinct was to come toward it after the bombing, and so got suspicious and left his room, got in a car, and started to follow the man who had gotten into a pickup truck. And ultimately, he got his license plate, and that was the ultimate tracking of Eric Rudolph.
Yes. The truck was at a McDonald's several miles away, and fortunately, the witness saw him coming out of the woods and went to the truck, and that's how he found out the tag number.
Let's talk about who Eric Rudolph is. Spent part of his youth living with the Army of God and with Christian Identity, a white supremacist religion, anti-gay, anti-Semitic, anti-foreigner. For years, the survivalist Army veteran hid deep in the forests of Appalachia from police who were equipped with bloodhounds and infrared-equipped helicopters and motion detectors. It's believed he received some help from people in the community or perhaps a member of his family. They sold T-shirts saying, "Run, Rudolph, run," and slipped pictures of dead fetuses on the cars of FBI and media joining the chase. We're also joined by Ann Glazier, who's director of Planned Parenthood Security. Though in both cases, neither of the women's health clinics that were bombed were Planned Parenthood facilities, how has Eric Rudolph affected these clinics, hundreds of Planned Parenthood clinics around the country, Ann?
I think the primary effect that it's had is to reinforce our ideas about security, that we need to have security and we need to offer that as a service exactly the way that we offer health services to women. And I think even with the capture of Rudolph, one of the things that we also have this year is the trial and sentencing of James Kopp, who assassinated Dr. Slepian in Buffalo. And both of those cases, I think, point to that we absolutely have to have security at our facilities, but also that we know how to do this and that we have some good ideas for law enforcement, and that we have to take part in keeping ourselves safe just as an average citizen has to do. And I think that's the message we get again from his from Rudolph's capture by local law enforcement, his recognition by another law enforcement agency, and then the subsequent.
It's interesting that Eric Rudolph, as well as Kopp, the man who was in, who was killed, who was convicted of
yes.
the killing of the Dr. Slepian, were caught under the Ashcroft administration, if you will, Ashcroft, head of the Justice Department. His own views very clear, has once said that if he could accomplish one thing in his life, it would be to end abortion in this country. This weekend, he said, Attorney General John Ashcroft, that we have caught the most notorious American fugitive on the FBI's most wanted list. He has been captured and will face American justice. The American people, most importantly, the victims of these terrorist attacks, can rest easier. Do you rest easier, Emily?
I'm sorry.
Ever since I came home, I've been resting easy. Other than the fact that he was still out there and nobody had found him yet, there was always the possibility he could hurt someone else. But now that we know that he can't hurt anyone else now.
You always believed he was alive?
I always believed, yes. And I believed he was still in the area there.
Ultimately, what happened to you? What were your injuries?
I lost my left eye. It damaged my right eye, so I have limited vision. It broke the right side of my face, first, second, and third degree burns on the front of my body. Broke my left leg. It destroyed arteries in my left leg that had to be rebuilt. Tore the muscle and skin off the front of my legs. Hole in my abdomen. My intestines were hanging out, as they said. Messed up my predominant hand and ruptured an eardrum. A few other things, but that's the big ones.
Ann Glazier, that he's been captured now during this time.
I don't rest easier. I'm very relieved that Rudolph has been captured, and I'm very relieved that Kopp has been sentenced. But the unfortunate message that we've had to experience is that someone will try to take their place, and that's what my concern is. And to go back for a minute, the capture and the bringing to justice of both of these people was a process that was started way before the Ashcroft Bush administration, and one of the things that happened during that period was a lot of people were educated about how much of a criminal act this is, that it is terrorism, that it's designed to make people afraid. I think the most amazing thing about Emily's story is that she never gave up. She absolutely refused to be terrorized, refused to be intimidated, and developed her message in her own way, but never was hit under the bed, so to speak, and which is the message of terrorism. You can't go anywhere, you can't do anything.
In addition to Emily Lyons, the nurse who was critically injured by the bombing of the Women's Health Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, the first attack that Eric Rudolph will be tried for, and Ann Glazer, director of Planned Parenthood Security, were joined on the phone by Chip Berlay, senior analyst at Political Research Associates, an independent center that studies authoritarian and other oppressive movements and institutions and trends, wrote a book called Right-Wing Populism in America. We've heard the descriptions of Eric Rudolph. He was a white supremacist survivalist. Can you tell us more?
Well, he was definitely influenced by Christian Identity, which explains the targeting, because I was just looking at some Christian Identity materials yesterday and today, looking at articles about abortion, and from the Christian Identity point of view, the racist version of Christian Identity, abortion is the extinguishing of the white race. So it's a very racist application of anti-abortion rhetoric. They also see gays and lesbians as sinful. They also are against race mixing and internationalism and globalism, thus the Olympics. And I think people need to really face the racism and sexism and homophobia in this alleged series of acts, because too many people are dismissing Eric Rudolph as some kind of nut when he really comes out of a political milieu that believes in killing its political adversaries as the carrying out the will of God.
It's interesting. We're going to have the head of Christian Coalition on today as well, but they pulled out. They said they didn't support what Eric Rudolph had done, and we asked them to come on to talk about that. But in the end, they said they didn't want to. Your thoughts on that, Chip?
Well, if people do need to be careful about drawing distinctions. Eric Rudolph comes out of Christian Identity, which is really a race-hate theology in its most virulent form. Many of the people who've attacked abortion clinics and reproductive rights centers around the country are part of a militant Christian evangelical sector that's very small. And I don't doubt that the Christian Coalition opposes acts of violence, but of course they then portray abortion providers in a way that leads some people to think that it might be appropriate to carry out acts of violence. So even though we're looking at three different sectors here, the Christian Coalition is a relatively mainstream conservative evangelical group. Christian Dominionists who kill abortion providers tend to come out of a much smaller doctrinaire section, often associated with Christian Reconstructionism. Christian Identity, which is a race-hate theology, you really make those distinctions, but then you have to say that they're all creating an environment in which women's health is at risk.
I'm going to give the final word to Emily Lyons in New York just for a few days and then headed back home to Birmingham. Will you be at the trial of Eric Rudolph?
Yes. Since it will be in Birmingham, I should be able to be easy to access the trial, and as much as I can tolerate sitting there, I will.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us, Emily Lyons, the nurse critically injured in the attack on the Women's Health Clinic in Birmingham, and Ann Glazer, head of Planned Parenthood Security, Chip Berlay with Political Research Associates. And that does it for our program. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, where you can see the program video and audio streaming and get contact information, is www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, with help from Rich Kim, and happy, very happy birthday to Angie Karen. Again, our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. And if you want to get a copy of today's show, 1-800-881-2359. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, the blood for down the picket line. trip, but it's immediate. Yeah, the vengeance was divine.